Today will be a little bit of a hybrid show, if you will, where we will get into some stuff that I actually saw that applies to the sports world. Good news if you're dying for content like I am, that ESPN wised up to show the Michael Jordan Last Dance documentary, and that's going to be shown in the middle of the month. That was an absolute no-brainer. I mean, what was the point of holding it off until June? I mean, if by some miracle there were games by the middle of June, guess what? We're going to want to watch the games. We're not going to be in nostalgia mode. We are not going to be in old school mode. We're going to be living in the here and now. We're going to be dying for action any which way we can. So, middle of April, Last Dance over on ESPN and ABC and all that good stuff. So, that is a documentary that I think many of us have on our list, because we're talking about a team that we knew quite well in the Michael Jordan Bulls and one of the great dynasties in the history of the NBA and really in the history of all our years of watching sports for that matter. So that was good news. Now, we get to some stuff a little bit later on involving Dave Gettleman and the New York Giants. And if you're a Giant fan, you saw the report that Jay Glazer put out in his mailbag. Let's just say it wouldn't be sitting particularly well with me knowing that Dave Gettleman again now is going to have the opportunity to go through yet another draft to kind of leave his mark on the New York Giants when the first 2 years of running the team has been nothing short of a nightmare. So I would be very, very concerned about that story that we saw from Jay Glazer, which we will get to later on in the show. But it has been the theme of my shows over the last, what, two and a half weeks? A whole lot of nostalgia. A whole lot of take me back. This notion of back to the future, I guess you could say. Maybe that's in my head because I saw the movie last night. I don't really know. I think our brains are all kind of fried. It's been that kind of week. It's been that kind of month. I mean, thank heavens the month of March is going to be over. Problem is, month of April, I don't think it's going to be much better. Same could be said for the month of May. Now, most of the topics of sports nostalgia that I've thrown your way, I have to admit, and I saw a few of these on Twitter, so I can't even say that, you know, I'm mindful of your critiques. I'm really not, because I'm going to do what I want to do. But sometimes the critiques are just totally off base. Other times, critiques have some form of merit. I do admit that in many of the exercises we have done together, sharing memories together, from a sports standpoint, at least for the last week with me, a lot of them have kind of had some negative vibes attached to them. Maybe it's the idea of Patrick Ewing wearing a Sonics jersey, or some of those horrific losses that you live through over the course of time. Yesterday, we went through, you know, teams that you ended up hating the most over, you know, a 3 or 4 year period, whatever it was. So I was very mindful of the fact that, you know what, we have been trending recently, at least, in this nostalgia negativity warp. I'm going to try to buck that trend a little bit today. Now, for some of you, it may not have that sort of feel. For some of you, it should absolutely have that sort of feel. But today was one of those days where, yeah, I went for my walk. I may have, you know, snuck on a particular park to swing a golf club. Social distancing, of course. And made some dinner. Did a puzzle. And I get ready to do another radio show. I mean, literally, that's what my life has been. Which is fine. I'm keeping safe. I know there are people out there protecting us and doing what needs to be done. And we're so thankful for that. And we're so appreciative of that. But for many of us, it's the idea of doing what we are being asked and being told to do. But as I'm sitting down and doing a puzzle, a Snoopy and Woodstock 550-piece puzzle, might I add, I'd say we're about a fifth of the way through. We got the borders basically done. Nitty-gritty, I guess, will come over the next few days. But I decided that on the television, we were going to throw on a sporting event. Feeling a little nostalgia. Just searching around. I want to see what was going to find my way. It ended up being a game that, let's just say, kind of holds a place near and dear in a lot of hearts over the tri-state area. And that would be Game 6 of the 1996 World Series. The Yankees clinching that 96 championship, down 2-0, rallying for four straight against the Braves. And that game was terrific. Getting to Greg Maddux, who dominated them in Game 2. The Girardi triple, which many will tell you is the loudest they ever heard. The old Yankee Stadium. And no, not the old Yankee Stadium. The post-renovation 1976 to 2008 Yankee Stadium. Sure seems that way if you're watching the replay. And if you're living through it like many of us did in 1996. Because the Yankees finally got to Maddux. Girardi with the rocket. Then it continues with Jeter and Bernie Williams. And it still felt like, and Joe Buck said it during the broadcast, Bob Brenly and Tim McCarver said it during the broadcast, that the entire press box and the upper deck and everything about that old place was shaken. Then the Yankees had a hold on for dear life at the end of that game. You know, a lot of people forget that. They only scored in one inning in that game. Jimmy Key game enough. The Yankee formula, of course, was going to the bullpen. Graham Lloyd, the great Mariano Rivera, and John Wetland, who always found a way to make it interesting, for better or worse. Certainly made it interesting, giving up a run and putting a couple of runners on base. And could you imagine the uproar on Twitter if Charlie Hayes went in the dugout the first and you had somebody on the Atlanta Braves, I believe it was a bat boy, not getting out of the way, interfering with his progress in the social media Twitter world that we live in? Oh my God, people be losing their minds. Then he gets another chance, he catches it, and of course, the Yankees go on and win that World Series. We all know that. But what the game in particular had me thinking about, because 1996, in many ways, came unexpectedly from a Yankee standpoint because of all the changes that were made in the offseason, because of the uncertainty with Joe Torre as the manager. Don Mattingly had retired. The roster had dramatically changed. Nobody really knew what to expect of that 96 group. And they were great in the first half. They exceeded everybody's expectations. They came crashing down to earth in the month of August. I remember it well. I want to say a 12-game lead against the Orioles. A very good Oriole team with Ripken and Palmeiro and Alomar. And Brady Anderson and his 50 home runs. And B.J. Surhoff. And a pitching staff that featured the likes of Messina, Scott Erickson, and David Wells. They were a damn good team. And they cut that deficit to 2 right around early September. And I think for many, because the Orioles were favored going into the year to win the division, the Orioles were a team that I think a lot of people looked at as one that had more talent. They wondered, would the Yankees fall apart? Would the Yankees lose out on the division? Didn't happen. They found a way to win it. And then they went into that postseason. And how remarkable is it now looking back? The Yankees in 1996 did not lose a game on the road. They won 2 games down in Texas. They won 3 games in Baltimore. And of course, they won the 3 games in Atlanta, coming from behind, down 2-0 against a Brave team that, let's be honest, folks, they thought they were on the verge of a dynasty. They were fully of the mindset after getting over those losses in 91 and 92 and beating the Indians in 1995 that the 96 season was supposed to be their coronation, that it was supposed to be them officially above and beyond leaving their mark on the game and on the sport. That did not happen. And as it turns out, you fast forward to 1999, that battle for team of the decade ended up going to the Yankees in far more dominant fashion, with the Yankees sweeping Atlanta in 4 straight games. But in many ways, from Torre to the Yankee bullpen, to the rise of Mariano Rivera. We play today, we win today, that's it. It's one of the more unexpected championships, I would say, we've had, not only here in New York, but we've seen, you know, over the last 30 or so years. Now, there are many more. I was going through a couple in my head, and from a football standpoint, I could give you two with these. And again, I'm doing this from my prism of being here on this earth. So I'm sure for the old timer right now who's listening to the show, 69 Mets are going to obviously apply. That goes without saying. That would top any of this. But they're part of the exercise, so feel free to share. But the two in football I thought of, and it's going to sound crazy now looking at one of these teams as an unexpected champion. The 2001 New England Patriots, Bill Belichick and Tom Brady's first Super Bowl was as unexpected as it gets. Remember, that was a Patriot team the year prior that went 5-11. That was a Patriot team that in the second week of the year lost their quarterback in Drew Bledsoe. Little did we know at the time the Mo Lewis hit on Drew Bledsoe would be the ultimate blessing for the Patriots. Because the rest, as they say in the business, is history with Tom Brady taking over and going to 9 Super Bowls and winning 6. But that first year, remember, the legend of Tom Brady was not there. He was this little-known quarterback out of Michigan that was getting an opportunity. Midway through that year, there were a whole lot of debates when the Patriots were right around 500. Should they go back to Drew Bledsoe? They didn't. They got hot. They basically ran the table and won the AFC East. And then think about their run in the postseason. The Tuck Rule game, which they were dead to rights, tied it up. Vinatieri with the field goals to win it. Bledsoe coming in off the bench, beating the Steelers, who were a one seed that year with Cordell Stewart, finding a way to win that game. And then, of course, with the backdrop, months after September 11th, the Patriots, Joe Andruzzi, remember the offensive lineman, his family had connections to the FDNY, Staten Island guy. YouTube before the game, Patriots were a massive, massive underdog against the St. Louis Rams in the greatest show on turf. Put together the unbelievable game plan. Ty Law, David Patton, Brady late when John Madden famously said the Patriots should take a knee and go to overtime after they yucked up a big lead. Love John Madden, one of the best to ever do it. That was probably some of the worst advice you could ever give in a telecast. And it happens. We all do it. We all make those mistakes. And that's where the legend of Tom Brady was born. But make no mistake, the 2001 New England Patriots, despite what they turned into, that team was as unexpected as it gets. The 1999 St. Louis Rams are in that exact same boat. And it turned out that they had a terrific team. They ended up being a number one seed. So I guess the difference between a team like the Rams in 99 and a team like the Patriots in 2001, the Patriots in 2001 were expected to lose all three of their playoff games. They were basically a pick'em against the Raiders, or right around that. They were an underdog against Pittsburgh, and they were a massive underdog against St. Louis. Now, the Rams that year were a joke. And I guess they fit the unexpected category because in 98, they were a bad football team. They go and they get Trent Green, remember, from the Washington Redskins. And it looked like Trent Green was going to be their quarterback. Gets hurt in preseason, blows out his knee. A little known entity in the sports world, a guy by the name of Kurt Warner, comes out of nowhere. The Rams come out of nowhere and put together an offense for the ages. They put together a season for the ages. So I would say their storyline with Vermeil and with Warner and their rise from the ashes makes them an unexpected champion. What doesn't make them an unexpected champion is what happened in the postseason, because they were a number one seed. They were favored to beat teams like Tampa Bay and the Tennessee Titans. So I guess it's the way you're going to look at it. And that's what I want to do over the next couple hours here, because I'm sure you guys can throw so many different ones my way in all four of the major sports. And listen, the United States hockey team in 1980, they're another one. I was only giving you the four major sports in Olympic play. That might top any list you may have, including the 69 Mets for that matter, with how big an underdog they were. And somebody's got to find out for me, and the power of the internet, I'm sure we can find this out at some point. Maybe I'll search it next break. I wonder on the betting line, what in the world the U.S. hockey team in 1980 was against the Soviet Union? They had to be plus 400, plus 500, easy, right? I mean, they got smoked in the exhibition in Madison Square Garden. They had to be plus 400 or 500. But what I want to do, and I think this will put everybody in a much better state of mind. You know, the last couple of days, I admit, not only what's going on here in New York City, but my topics have trended in that negative direction. We're not going to do that today. But I want you guys to dig deep and give me those unexpected champions. The 96 Yankees come to mind. The 69 Mets come to mind. I gave you two in the NFL. I got a couple in the NBA. I got a couple in college basketball.